German-Russian relations on a new and definitive basis. It was known at the Foreign Office that Schulenburg was seeing Molotov later in the day. An hour after Ribbentrop's telegram was dispatched, Weizsäcker got off one of his own, also marked secret, most urgent. In view of the political situation and in the interests of speed, we are anxious, without prejudice to your conversation with Molotov today, to continue in more concrete terms in Berlin the conversations on harmonizing German-Soviet intentions. To this end, Schnurrer will receive Ostakov today and will tell him that we would be ready for a continuation on more concrete terms. Though Ribbentrop's sudden desire for concrete talks on everything from the Baltic to the Black Sea must have surprised the Russians, at one point, as he informed Schulenburg in his following telegram, which was sent at 3:47 p.m., he dropped a gentle hint to Ostakov at our coming to an understanding with Russia on the fate of Poland. The foreign minister emphasized to his ambassador in Moscow that he had told the Russian chargé that we were in no hurry. This was bluff, and the sharp-minded Soviet chargé called it when he saw Schnurrer at the Foreign Office at 12:45 p.m. He remarked that while Schnurrer seemed to be in a hurry, the German foreign minister the previous day had shown no such urgency. Schnurrer rose to the occasion. "I told Monsieur Ostakov," he noted in a secret memorandum, "that though the foreign minister last night had not shown any urgency to the Soviet government, we nevertheless thought it expedient to make use of the next few days for continuing the conversations in order to establish a basis as quickly as possible." For the Germans, then, it had come down to a matter of the next few days. Ostakov told Schnurrer that he had received a provisional answer from Molotov to the German suggestions. It was largely negative. While Moscow, too, desired an improvement in relations, Molotov said, he reported, that so far nothing concrete was known of Germany's attitude. The Soviet foreign commissar conveyed his ideas directly to Schulenburg in Moscow that evening. The ambassador reported in a long dispatch filed shortly after midnight that in a talk lasting an hour and a quarter, Molotov had abandoned his habitual reserve and appeared unusually open. There seems no doubt of that. For after Schulenburg had reiterated Germany's view that no differences existed between the two countries from the Baltic to the Black Sea, and reaffirmed the German wish to come to an understanding, the unbending Russian minister enumerated some of the hostile acts that the Reich had committed against the Soviet Union. The Anti-Comintern Pact, support of Japan against Russia, and the exclusion of the Soviets from Munich. "How," asked Molotov, "could the new German statements be reconciled with these three points? Proofs of a changed attitude of the German government were, for the present, still lacking." Schulenburg seems to have been somewhat discouraged. "My general impression," he telegraphed Berlin, "is that the Soviet government are at present determined to conclude an agreement with Britain and France, if they fulfill all Soviet wishes. I believe that my statements made an impression on Molotov. It will nevertheless require considerable effort on our part to cause a reversal in the Soviet government's course." Knowledgeable, though the veteran German diplomat was about Russian affairs, he obviously overestimated the progress in Moscow of the British and French negotiators. Nor did he yet realize the lengths to which Berlin was now prepared to go to make the considerable effort which he thought was necessary to reverse the course of Soviet diplomacy. In the Wilhelmstrasse, confidence grew that this could be accomplished. With Russia neutralized, Britain and France either would not fight for Poland, or if they did, would easily be held on the western fortifications until the Poles were quickly liquidated and the German army could turn its full strength on the west. The astute French chargé d'affaires in Berlin, Jacques Tarbé de Saint-Ardouin, noticed the change of atmosphere in the German capital. On the very day, August 3rd, when there was so much Soviet-German diplomatic activity in Berlin and Moscow, he reported to Paris, "In the course of the last week, a very definite change in the political atmosphere has been observed in Berlin. The period of embarrassment, hesitation, inclination to temporization, or even to appeasement has been succeeded among the Nazi leaders by a new phase." The hesitation of Germany's allies. It was different with Germany's allies, Italy and Hungary. As the summer progressed, the governments in Budapest and Rome became increasingly fearful that their countries would be drawn into Hitler's war on Germany's side. On July 24th, Count Teleki, Premier of Hungary, addressed identical letters to Hitler and Mussolini, informing them that, in the event of a general conflict, Hungary will make her policy conform to the policy of the Axis. Having gone so far, he then pulled back. On the same day, he wrote the two dictators a second letter, stating that, in order to prevent any possible misinterpretation of my letter of July 24th, I repeat that Hungary could not, on moral grounds, be in a position to take armed action against Poland. The second letter from Budapest threw Hitler into one of his accustomed rages. When he received Count Shaki, the Hungarian foreign minister, at Obersalzberg on August 8th in the presence of Ribbentrop, he opened the conversation by stating that he had been shocked at the Hungarian prime minister's letter. He emphasized, according to the confidential memorandum drawn up for the Foreign Office, that he had never expected help from Hungary, or from any other state, in the event of a German-Polish conflict. Count Teleki's letter, he added, was impossible, and he reminded his Hungarian guest that it was due to Germany's generosity that Hungary had been able to regain so much territory at the expense of Czechoslovakia. Were Germany to be defeated in war, he said, Hungary would be automatically smashed too. The German memorandum of this conversation, which is among the captured Foreign Office documents, reveals Hitler's state of mind as the fateful month of August got underway. Poland, he said, presented no military problem at all for Germany. Nevertheless, he was reckoning from the start with a war on two fronts. No power in the world, he boasted, could penetrate Germany's western fortifications. Nobody in all my life has been able to frighten me, and that goes for Britain. Nor will I succumb to the oft-predicted nervous breakdown. As for Russia, the Soviet government would not fight against us. The Soviets would not repeat the Tsar's mistake and bleed to death for Britain. They would, however, try to enrich themselves, possibly at the expense of the Baltic states or Poland, without engaging in military action themselves. So effective was Hitler's harangue that at the end of a second talk held the same day, Count Shaki requested him to regard the two letters written by Teleki as not having been written. He said he would also make the same request of Mussolini. For some weeks, the Duce had been worrying and fretting about the danger of the Führer dragging Italy into war. Attolico, his ambassador in Berlin, had been sending increasingly alarming reports about Hitler's determination to attack Poland. Typical was a vivid report Attolico sent of a talk he had with Ribbentrop on July 6th. If Poland dared to attack Danzig, the Nazi foreign minister told him, Germany would settle the Danzig question in 48 hours, at Warsaw. If France were to intervene over Danzig and so precipitate a general war, let her. Germany would like nothing better. France would be annihilated. Britain, if she stirred, would be bringing destruction on the British Empire. Russia? There was going to be a Russian-German treaty, and Russia was not going to march. America? One speech of the Führer's had been enough to rout Roosevelt, and Americans would not stir anyway. Fear of Japan would keep America quiet. I listened, Attolico reported, in wondering silence while Ribbentrop drew this picture of the war ad usum Germaniae, which his imagination has now established indelibly in his head. He can see nothing but his version, which is a really amazing one, of an assured German victory in every field and against all comers. At the end, I observed that, according to my understanding, there was complete agreement between the Duce and the Führer that Italy and Germany were preparing for a war that was not to be immediate. But the astute Attolico did not believe that at all. All through July, his dispatches warned of imminent German action in Poland. Since early June, Mussolini had been pressing for another meeting with Hitler, and in July it was fixed for August 4th at the Brenner. On July 24th, he presented to Hitler through Attolico certain basic principles for their discussion. If the Führer considered war inevitable, then Italy would stand by her side. But the Duce reminded him that a war with Poland could not be localized. It would become a European conflict. Mussolini did not think that this was the time for the Axis to start such a war. He proposed instead a constructive, peaceful policy over several years, with Germany settling her differences with Poland and Italy hers with France by diplomatic negotiation. He went further. He suggested another international conference of the big powers. The Führer's reaction, as Chano noted in his diary on July 26th, was unfavorable, and Mussolini decided it might be best to postpone his meeting with Hitler. He proposed instead on August 7th that the foreign ministers of the two countries meet immediately. Ciano's diary notes during these days indicate the growing uneasiness in Rome. On August 6th, he wrote, "We must find some way out. By following the Germans, we shall go to war and enter it under the least favorable conditions for the Axis, and especially for Italy. Our gold reserves are reduced to almost nothing, as well as our stocks of metals. We must avoid war. I proposed to the Duce the idea of my meeting with Ribbentrop, during which I would attempt to continue discussion of Mussolini's project for a world conference." August 9th. "Ribbentrop has approved the idea of our meeting. I decided to leave tomorrow night in order to meet him at Salzburg. The Duce is anxious that I prove to the Germans, by documentary evidence, that the outbreak of war at this time would be folly." August 10th. "The Duce is more than ever convinced of the necessity of delaying the conflict. He himself has worked out the outline of a report concerning the meeting at Salzburg, which ends with an allusion to international negotiations to settle the problems that so dangerously disturb European life. Before letting me go, he recommends that I shall frankly inform the Germans that we must avoid a conflict with Poland, since it will be impossible to localize it, and a general war would be disastrous for everybody." Armed with such commendable, but in the circumstances, naive thoughts and recommendations, the youthful fascist foreign minister set out for Germany, where during the next 3 days, August 11th, 12th, and 13th, he received from Ribbentrop, and especially from Hitler, the shock of his life. Ciano at Salzburg and Obersalzburg, August 11th, 12th, 13th. For some 10 hours on August 11th, Ciano conferred with Ribbentrop at the latter's estate at Fuschl, outside Salzburg, which the Nazi foreign minister had taken from an Austrian monarchist who, conveniently, had been put away in a concentration camp. The hot-blooded Italian found the atmosphere, as he later reported, cold and gloomy. During dinner at the White Horse Inn at St. Wolfgang, not a word was exchanged between the two. It was scarcely necessary. Ribbentrop had informed his visitor earlier in the day that the decision to attack Poland was implacable. "Well, Ribbentrop," Ciano says he asked, "what do you want, the corridor or Danzig?" "Not that anymore," Ribbentrop replied, gazing at him with his cold metallic eyes. "We want war." Ciano's arguments that a Polish conflict could not be localized, that if Poland were attacked the Western democracies would fight, were bluntly rejected. The day before Christmas Eve, 4 years later, 1943, when Ciano lay in cell 27 of the Verona jail waiting execution at the instigation of the Germans, he still remembered that chilling day of August 11th at Fuschl and Salzburg. "Ribbentrop," he wrote in his very last diary entry on December 23rd, 1943, "had bet him, during one of those gloomy meals at the Österreichischer Hof in Salzburg, a collection of old German armor against an Italian painting, that France and Britain would remain neutral. A bet," he remarks ruefully, "which was never paid." Ciano moved on to Obersalzburg, where Hitler, during 2 meetings on August 12th and 13th, reiterated that France and Britain would not fight. In contrast to the Nazi foreign minister, the Führer was cordial, but he was equally implacable in his determination to go to war. This is evident not only from Ciano's reports, but from the confidential German minutes of the meeting, which are among the captured documents. The Italian minister found Hitler standing before a large table covered with military staff maps. He began by explaining the strength of Germany's West Wall. It was, he said, impenetrable. Besides, he added scornfully, Britain could put only 3 divisions into France. France would have considerably more, but since Poland would be defeated in a very short time, Germany could then concentrate 100 divisions in the West for the life-and-death struggle which would then commence. But would it? A few moments later, annoyed by Ciano's initial response, the Führer was contradicting himself. The Italian minister, as he had promised himself, spoke up to Hitler. According to the German minutes, he expressed Italy's great surprise at the entirely unexpected gravity of the situation. Germany, he complained, had not kept her ally informed. On the contrary, he said, the Reich foreign minister had stated, at Milan and Berlin in May, that the Danzig question would be settled in due course. When Chano went on to declare that a conflict with Poland would spread into a European war, his host interrupted to say that he differed. "I personally," said Hitler, "am absolutely convinced that the Western democracies will, in the last resort, recoil from unleashing a general war." To which Chano replied, the German minutes add, that he hoped the Führer would prove right, but he did not believe it. The Italian foreign minister then outlined in great detail Italy's weaknesses, and from his tale of woe, as the Germans recorded it, Hitler must have been finally convinced that Italy would be of little help to him in the coming war. At one point, Ribbentrop, with obvious exasperation, told Chano, "We don't need you," to which Chano replied, "The future will show." From General Halder's unpublished diary, entry of August 14th, Halder says he got it through Weizsäcker. One of Mussolini's reasons, Chano said, for wanting to postpone the war was that he attached great importance to holding, according to plan, the World Exhibition of 1942, a remark that must have astounded the Führer, lost as he was in his military maps and calculations. He must have been equally astounded when Chano naively produced the text of a communique, which he urged to be published, stating that the meeting of the Axis ministers had reaffirmed the peaceful intentions of their governments and their belief that peace could be maintained through normal diplomatic negotiations. Chano explained that the Duce had in mind a peace conference of the chief European nations, but that out of deference to the Führer's misgivings, he would settle for ordinary diplomatic negotiations. Hitler did not, the first day, turn down completely the idea of a conference, but reminded Chano that Russia could no longer be excluded from future meetings of the powers. This was the first mention of the Soviet Union, but it was not the last. Finally, when Chano tried to pin his host down as to the date of the attack on Poland, Hitler replied that because of the autumn rains, which would render useless his armored and motorized divisions in a country with few paved roads, the settlement with Poland would have to be made one way or another by the end of August. At last, Chano had the date, or the last possible date, for a moment later Hitler was storming that if the Poles offered any fresh provocation he was determined to attack Poland within 48 hours. Therefore, he added, a move against Poland must be expected any moment. That outburst ended the first day's talks, except for Hitler's promise to think over the Italian proposals. Having given them 24 hours' thought, he told Chano the next day that it would be better if no communique of any kind were issued about their talks. Though the German minutes explicitly state that Chano agreed with Hitler that no communique should be issued at the conclusion of the conversation, the Germans immediately double-crossed their Italian ally. DNB, the official German news agency, issued a communique 2 hours after Chano's departure, and without any consultation whatever with the Italians, that the talks had covered all the problems of the day, with particular attention to Danzig, and had resulted in 100% agreement. So much so, the communique added, that not a single problem had been left in suspense, and therefore there would be no further meetings because there was no occasion for them. Atolico was furious. He protested to the Germans, accusing them of bad faith. He tipped off Henderson that war was imminent, and in an angry dispatch to Rome he described the German communique as Machiavellian, pointing out that it was deliberately done to bind Italy to Germany after the latter's attack on Poland, and pleaded that Mussolini should be firm with Hitler in demanding German fulfillment of the consultation provisions of the Pact of Steel, and under these provisions insist on a month's grace to settle the Danzig question through diplomatic channels. Because of the expected bad weather in the fall, it was of decisive importance, firstly, Hitler told Chano, that within the shortest possible time Poland should make her intentions plain, and secondly, that no further acts of provocation of any sort should be tolerated by Germany. When Chano inquired as to what the shortest possible time was, Hitler replied, by the end of August at the latest. While it would take only a fortnight, he explained, to defeat Poland, the final liquidation would require a further 2 to 4 weeks. A remarkable forecast of timing, as it turned out. Finally, at the end, Hitler uttered his customary flattery of Mussolini, whom Chano must have convinced him he could no longer count on. He personally felt fortunate, he declared, to live at a time when, apart from himself, there was another statesman living who could stand out in history as a great and unique figure. It was a source of great personal happiness that he could be a friend of this man, When the hour struck for the common fight, he would always be found at the side of the Duce, come what may. However much the strutting Mussolini might be impressed by such words, his son-in-law was not. "I returned to Rome," he wrote in his diary on August 13th, after the second meeting with Hitler, "completely disgusted with the Germans, with their leader, with their way of doing things. They have betrayed us and lied to us. Now they are dragging us into an adventure which we have not wanted, and which might compromise the regime and the country as a whole." But Italy at the moment was the least of Hitler's concerns. His thoughts were concentrating on Russia. Toward the end of the meeting with Ciano on August 12th, a telegram from Moscow, as the German minutes put it, was handed to the Führer. The conversation was interrupted for a few moments while Hitler and Ribbentrop perused it. They then informed Ciano of its contents. "The Russians," Hitler said, "have agreed to a German political negotiator being sent to Moscow." Chapter 15. The Nazi-Soviet Pact. The telegram from Moscow, whose contents Hitler disclosed to Ciano at Obersalzberg on the afternoon of August 12th, appears to have been, like certain previous telegrams which have figured in this narrative, of doubtful origin. No such wire from the Russian capital has been found in the German archives. Schulenberg did send a telegram to Berlin from Moscow on the 12th, but it merely reported the arrival of the Franco-British military missions and the friendly toasts exchanged between the Russians and their guests. Yet there was some basis for the telegram with which Hitler and Ribbentrop had so obviously tried to impress Ciano. On August 12th, a teleprint was sent to Obersalzberg from the Wilhelmstrasse, reporting the results of a call which the Russian chargé had made on Schnurre in Berlin on that day. Ostakov informed the Foreign Office official that Molotov was now ready to discuss the questions raised by the Germans, including Poland and other political matters. The Soviet government proposed Moscow as the place of these negotiations. But, Ostakov made it clear, they were not to be hurried. He stressed, Schnurre noted in his report, which apparently was rushed to Obersalzberg, that the chief emphasis in his instructions from Molotov lay in the phrase, by degrees. The discussions could be undertaken only by degrees. But Adolf Hitler could not wait for negotiations with Russia by degrees. As he had just revealed to a shocked Ciano, he had set the last possible date for the onslaught on Poland for September 1st. And it was now almost the middle of August. If he were to successfully sabotage the Anglo-French parleys with the Russians and swing his own deal with Stalin, it had to be done quickly, not by stages, but in one big leap. Monday, August 14th, was another crucial day. While Ambassador von der Schulenberg, who obviously had not yet been taken fully into the confidence of Hitler and Ribbentrop, was writing Weizsäcker from Moscow advising him that Molotov was a strange man and a difficult character, and that I am still of the opinion that any hasty measures in our relations with the Soviet Union should be avoided, he was being sent a most urgent telegram from Berlin. It came from Ribbentrop, and it was dispatched from the Wilhelmstrasse, the foreign minister was still at Fuschel, at 10:53 p.m. on August 14th. It directed the German ambassador to call upon Molotov and read him a long communication verbatim. This, finally, was Hitler's great bid. "German-Russian relations," said Ribbentrop, "had come to a historic turning point. There exist no real conflicts of interests between Germany and Russia. It has gone well with both countries previously when they were friends and badly when they were enemies. The crisis which has been produced in Polish-German relations by English policy," Ribbentrop continued, "and the attempts at an alliance which are bound up with that policy make a speedy clarification of German-Russian relations necessary. Otherwise, matters might take a turn which would deprive both governments of the possibility of restoring German-Russian friendship and in due course clarifying jointly territorial questions in Eastern Europe. The leadership of both countries, therefore, should not allow the situation to drift, but should take action at the proper time. It would be fatal if, through mutual ignorance of views and intentions, the two peoples should finally drift apart." The German foreign minister, in the name of the Führer, was therefore prepared to act in proper time. As we have been informed, the Soviet government also feel the desire for a clarification of German-Russian relations. Since, however, according to previous experience, this clarification can be achieved only slowly through the usual diplomatic channels, I am prepared to make a short visit to Moscow in order, in the name of the Führer, to set forth the Führer's views to Monsieur Stalin. In my view, only through such a direct discussion can a change be brought about, and it should not be impossible thereby to lay the foundations for a final settlement of German-Russian relations. The British Foreign Secretary had not been willing to go to Moscow, but now the German Foreign Minister was not only willing but anxious to go, a contrast which the Nazis calculated quite correctly would make an impression on the suspicious Stalin. The Germans saw that it was highly important to get their message through to the Russian dictator himself. Ribbentrop therefore added an annex to his urgent telegram. "I request," Ribbentrop advised Schulenburg, "that you do not give Monsieur Molotov these instructions in writing, but that they reach Monsieur Stalin in as exact a form as possible, and I authorize you, if the occasion arises, to request from Monsieur Molotov on my behalf an audience with Monsieur Stalin, so that you may be able to make this important communication directly to him also. In addition to a conference with Molotov, a detailed discussion with Stalin would be a condition for my making the trip." There was a scarcely disguised bait in the foreign minister's proposal, which the Germans, not without reason, must have thought the Kremlin would rise to. Reiterating that there is no question between the Baltic Sea and the Black Sea which cannot be settled to the complete satisfaction of both countries, Ribbentrop specified the Baltic states, Poland, southeastern questions, etc. And he spoke of the necessity of clarifying jointly territorial questions of Eastern Europe. Germany was ready to divide up Eastern Europe, including Poland, with the Soviet Union. This was a bid which Britain and France could not, and obviously, if they could, would not, match. And having made it, Hitler, apparently confident that it would not be turned down, once more, on the same day, August 14th, called in the commanders-in-chief of his armed forces to listen to him lecture on the plans and prospects for war. The Military Conference at Obersalzberg, August 14th. The only source found for what happened at this meeting is in the unpublished diary of General Halder, Chief of the Army General Staff. It is the first entry, August 14th, 1939. Halder kept his diary in Gabelsberger shorthand, and it is an immensely valuable record of the most confidential military and political goings-on in Nazi Germany from August 14th, 1939, to September 24, 1942, when he was dismissed from his post. The Obersalzberg entry consists of Halder's shorthand notes jotted down while Hitler spoke, and a summary which he added at the end. It is strange that no American or British publisher has published the Halder diary. The writer had access to the German longhand version of it, transcribed by Halder himself during the writing of this volume. Hitler's daily record book confirms the date of this meeting and adds that besides the commanders-in-chief, Brauchitsch, Goering, and Raeder, Dr. Todt, the engineer who built the West Wall, also was present. "The great drama," Hitler told his select listeners, "is now approaching its climax. While political and military successes could not be had without taking risks, he was certain that Great Britain and France would not fight. For one thing, Britain has no leaders of real caliber. The men I got to know at Munich are not the kind that start a new world war." As at previous meetings with his military chiefs, the Führer could not keep his mind off England, and he spoke in considerable detail of her strengths and weaknesses, especially the latter. "England," Halder noted down the words, "unlike in 1914, will not allow herself to blunder into a war lasting for years. Such is the fate of rich countries. Not even England has the money nowadays to fight a world war. What should England fight for? You don't get yourself killed for an ally." "What military measures," Hitler asked, "could Britain and France undertake?" "Drive against the West Wall, unlikely," he answered. "A northward swing through Belgium and Holland will not bring speedy victory. None of this would help the Poles. All these factors argue against England and France entering the war. There is nothing to force them into it. The men of Munich will not take the risk. English and French general staffs take a very sober view of the prospects of an armed conflict and advise against it. All this supports the conviction that while England may talk big, even recall her ambassador, perhaps put a complete embargo on trade, she is sure not to resort to armed intervention in the conflict. So Poland probably could be taken on alone, but she would have to be defeated within a week or two, Hitler explained, so that the world could be convinced of her collapse and not try to save her. Hitler was not quite ready to tell his generals just how far he was going that very day to make a deal with Russia, though it would have immensely pleased them, convinced as they were that Germany could not fight a major war on two fronts. But he told them enough to whet their appetite for more. Russia, he said, is not in the least disposed to pull chestnuts out of the fire. He explained the loose contacts with Moscow, which had started with the trade negotiations. He was now considering whether a negotiator should go to Moscow and whether this should be a prominent figure. The Soviet Union, he declared, felt under no obligation to the West. The Russians understood the destruction of Poland. They were interested in a delimitation of spheres of interest. The Führer was inclined to meet them halfway. In all of Halder's voluminous shorthand notes on the meeting, there is no mention that he, the chief of the army's general staff, or General von Brauchitsch, its commander-in-chief, or Goering, questioned the Führer's course in leading Germany into a European conflict. For despite Hitler's confidence, it was by no means certain that France and Britain would not fight, nor that Russia would stay out. In fact, exactly a week before, Goering had received a direct warning that the British would certainly fight if Germany attacked Poland. Early in July, a Swedish friend of his, Birger Dahlerus, had tried to convince him that British public opinion would not stand for further Nazi aggression, and when the Luftwaffe chief expressed his doubts, had arranged for him to meet privately with a group of seven British businessmen on August 7th in Schleswig-Holstein, near the Danish border, where Dahlerus had a house. The British businessmen, both orally and in a written memorandum, did their best to persuade Goering that Great Britain would stand by its treaty obligations with Poland should Germany attack. Whether they succeeded is doubtful, though Dahlerus, a businessman himself, thought so. Dahlerus told the Nuremberg Tribunal on March 19, 1946, when he was on the stand as a witness for Goering, that the Field Marshal had assured the British businessmen on his word of honor that he would do everything in his power to avert war. But Goering's state of mind at this time may have been more accurately expressed in a statement he made 2 days after seeing the British visitors. In boasting about the Luftwaffe's air defenses, he said, "The Ruhr will not be subjected to a single bomb. If an enemy bomber reaches the Ruhr, my name is not Hermann Goering. You can call me Meyer." A boast he was soon to rue. This curious Swede, Dahlerus, who was to play a certain role as a peacemaker between Germany and Britain in the next hectic weeks, certainly had high connections in Berlin and London. He had access to Downing Street, where on July 20th he had been received by Lord Halifax, with whom he discussed the coming meeting of British businessmen with Goering, and soon he would be called in by Hitler and Chamberlain themselves. But, though well-meaning in his quest to save the peace, he was naive and, as a diplomat, dreadfully amateurish. Years later at Nuremberg, Sir David Maxwell Fife, in a devastating cross-examination, led the Swedish diplomatic interloper to admit sadly that he had been badly misled by Goering and Hitler. And why did not General Halder, who had been the ringleader in the plot 11 months before to remove Hitler, speak up on August 14th to oppose the Führer's determination to go to war? Or, if he thought that useless, why did he not renew plans to get rid of the dictator on the same grounds as just before Munich, that a war now would be disastrous for Germany? Much later, in his interrogation at Nuremberg, Halder would explain that even at mid-August 1939, he simply did not believe that Hitler would, in the end, risk war, regardless of what he said. Also, a diary entry of August 15th, the day after the meeting with Hitler at the Berghof, shows that Halder did not believe that France and Britain would risk war either. As for Brauchitsch, he was not the man to question what the Führer planned to do. Hassel, who on August 15th learned of the military conference at the Obersalzberg from Gisevius, got word through to the army chief that he was absolutely convinced that Britain and France would intervene if Germany invaded Poland. "Nothing can be done with him," Hassel noted sadly in his diary. "Either he is afraid or he doesn't understand what it is all about. Nothing is to be hoped for from the generals. Only a few have kept clear heads. Halder, Canaris, Tomas." Only General Tomas, the brilliant head of the Economic and Armaments Branch of OKW, dared to openly challenge the Führer. A few days after the August 14th military conference, following a discussion with the now largely inactive conspirators Goerdeler, Beck, and Schacht, General Tomas drew up a memorandum and personally read it to General Keitel, the chief of OKW. A quick war and a quick peace were a complete illusion, he argued. An attack on Poland would unleash a world war, and Germany lacked the raw materials and the food supplies to fight it. But Keitel, whose only ideas were those he absorbed from Hitler, scoffed at the very idea of a big war. Britain was too decadent, France too degenerate, America too uninterested to fight for Poland, he said. And so, as the second half of August 1939 began, the German military chiefs pushed forward with their plans to annihilate Poland and to protect the Western Reich just in case the democracies, contrary to all evidence, did intervene. On August 15th, the annual Nuremberg Party Rally, which Hitler on April 1st had proclaimed as the Party Rally of Peace, and which was scheduled to begin the first week in September, was secretly cancelled. A quarter of a million men were called up for the armies of the West. Advance mobilization orders to the railways were given. Plans were made to move army headquarters to Zossen, east of Berlin. And on the same day, August 15th, the Navy reported that the pocket battleships Graf Spee and Deutschland and 21 submarines were ready to sail for their stations in the Atlantic. On August 17th, General Halder made a strange entry in his diary. Canaris checked with Section 1, Operations, Himmler, Heydrich, Obersalzberg. 150 Polish uniforms with accessories for Upper Silesia. What did it mean? It was only after the war that it became clear. It concerned one of the most bizarre incidents ever arranged by the Nazis. Just as Hitler and his army chiefs, it will be remembered, had considered cooking up an incident, such as the assassination of the German minister in order to justify their invading Austria and Czechoslovakia, so now they concerned themselves, as time began to run out, with concocting an incident which would, at least in their opinion, justify before the world the planned aggression against Poland. The code name was Operation Himmler, and the idea was quite simple and crude. The SS Gestapo would stage a faked attack on the German radio station at Gliwice, near the Polish border, using condemned concentration camp inmates outfitted in Polish army uniforms. Thus, Poland could be blamed for attacking Germany. Early in August, Admiral Canaris, chief of the Abwehr section of OKW, had received an order from Hitler himself to deliver to Himmler and Heydrich 150 Polish uniforms and some Polish small arms. This struck him as a strange business, and on August 17th he asked General Keitel about it. While the spineless OKW chief declared he did not think much of actions of this kind, he nevertheless told the admiral that nothing could be done, since the order had come from the Führer. Repelled though he was, Canaris obeyed his instructions and turned the uniforms over to Heydrich. The chief of the SD chose as the man to carry out the operation a young SS Secret Service veteran by the name of Alfred Helmut Naujoks. This was not the first of such assignments given this weird individual, nor would it be the last. Early in March of 1939, shortly before the German occupation of Czechoslovakia, Naujoks, at Heydrich's instigation, had busied himself running explosives into Slovakia, where they were used, as he later testified, to create incidents. Alfred Naujoks was a typical product of the SS Gestapo, a sort of intellectual gangster. He had studied engineering at Kiel University, where he got his first taste of brawling with anti-Nazis. On one occasion, he had his nose bashed in by communists. He had joined the SS in 1931 and was attached to the SD from its inception in 1934. Like so many other young men around Heydrich, he dabbled in what passed as intellectual pursuits in the SS, history and philosophy especially. While rapidly emerging as a tough young man, Skorzeny was another, who could be entrusted with the carrying out of the less savory projects dreamed up by Himmler and Heydrich. Naujoks had a hand in the Venlo incident, which will be recounted further on. He was involved in an undertaking to disguise German soldiers in Dutch and Belgian frontier guard uniforms at the time of the invasion of the West in May 1940. Early in the war, he managed a section of the SD which forged passports and, while thus employed, proposed Operation Bernhardt, a fantastic plan to drop forged British banknotes over England. Heydrich eventually tired of him and forced him to serve in the ranks of an SS regiment in Russia, where he was wounded. In 1944, Naujoks turned up in Belgium as an economic administrator, but his principal job at that time appears to have been to carry out in Denmark the murder of a number of members of the Danish resistance movement. He probably deserted to the American army in Belgium to save his neck. In fact, he had a charmed life. Held as a war criminal, he made a dramatic escape from a special camp in Germany for war criminals in 1946 and thus escaped trial. At the time of writing, he has never been apprehended or heard of. An account of his escape is given in Schaumburg-Lippe, Zwischen Krone und Kerker. On October 19, 1944, Naujoks deserted to the Americans and at Nuremberg a year later made a number of sworn affidavits, in one of which he preserved for history the account of the incident which Hitler used to justify his attack on Poland. On or about August 10, 1939, the chief of the SD, Heydrich, personally ordered me to simulate an attack on the radio station near Gliwice, near the Polish border, Naujoks related in an affidavit signed in Nuremberg, November 20, 1945, and to make it appear that the attacking force consisted of Poles, Heydrich said, practical proof is needed for these attacks of the Poles for the foreign press as well as for German propaganda. My instructions were to seize the radio station and to hold it long enough to permit a Polish-speaking German, who would be put at my disposal, to broadcast a speech in Polish. Heydrich told me that this speech should state that the time had come for conflict between Germans and Poles. Heydrich also told me that he expected an attack on Poland by Germany in a few days. I went to Gliwice and waited there 14 days. Between the 25th and 31st of August, I went to see Heinrich Müller, head of the Gestapo, who was then nearby at Opeln. In my presence, Müller discussed with a man named Mellhorn plans for another border incident in which it should be made to appear that Polish soldiers were attacking German troops. SS Oberfuhrer Dr. Mellhorn, who administered the SD under Heydrich. Schellenberg, in his memoirs, The Labyrinth, pages 48 to 50, recounts that Mellhorn told him on August 26 that he had been put in charge of staging the faked attack at Gliwice, but that Mellhorn got out of it by feigning illness. Mellhorn's stomach grew stronger in later years. During the war, he was a notable instigator of Gestapo terror in Poland. Müller stated that he had 12 to 13 condemned criminals who were to be dressed in Polish uniforms and left dead on the ground of the scene of the incident to show they had been killed while attacking. For this purpose, they were to be given fatal injections by a doctor employed by Heydrich. Then they were also to be given gunshot wounds. After the incident, members of the press and other persons were to be taken to the spot of the incident. Müller told me he had an order from Heydrich to make one of those criminals available to me for the action at Gliwice. The code name by which he referred to these criminals was Canned Goods. While Himmler, Heydrich, and Müller, at Hitler's command, were arranging for the use of canned goods to fake an excuse for Germany's aggression against Poland, the Führer made his first decisive move to deploy his armed forces for a possibly bigger war. On August 19th, another fateful day, orders to sail were issued to the German Navy. 21 submarines were directed to put out for positions north and northwest of the British Isles, the pocket battleship Graf Spee to depart for waters off the Brazilian coast, and her sister ship, the Deutschland, to take a position athwart the British sea lanes in the North Atlantic. The submarines sailed between August 19th and 23rd, the Graf Spee on the 21st and the Deutschland on the 24th. The date of the order to dispatch the warships for possible action against Britain is significant. For on August 19th, after a hectic week of frantic appeals from Berlin, the Soviet government finally gave Hitler the answer he wanted. The Nazi-Soviet Talks, August 15th to 21st, 1939. Ambassador von der Schulenburg saw Molotov at 8 p.m. on August 15th, and as instructed, read to him Ribbentrop's urgent telegram stating that the Reich Foreign Minister was prepared to come to Moscow to settle Soviet-German relations. According to a most urgent secret telegram which the German envoy got off to Berlin later that night, The Soviet Foreign Commissar received the information with the greatest interest and warmly welcomed German intentions of improving relations with the Soviet Union. However, expert diplomatic poker player that he was, Molotov gave no sign of being in a hurry. Such a trip as Ribbentrop proposed, he suggested, required adequate preparation in order that the exchange of opinions might lead to results. What results? The wily Russian dropped some hints. Would the German government, he asked, be interested in a non-aggression pact between the two countries? Would it be prepared to use its influence with Japan to improve Soviet-Japanese relations and eliminate border conflicts? A reference to an undeclared war which had raged all summer on the Manchurian-Mongolian frontier. Finally, Molotov asked, how did Germany feel about a joint guarantee of the Baltic states? All such matters, he concluded, must be discussed in concrete terms so that should the German foreign minister come here, it will not be a matter of an exchange of opinions, but of making concrete decisions. And he stressed again that adequate preparation of the problems is indispensable. The first suggestion, then, for a Nazi-Soviet non-aggression pact came from the Russians. At the very moment they were negotiating with France and Great Britain to go to war, if necessary, to oppose further German aggression. The British government soon learned of this. On August 17, Sumner Wells, the U.S. Undersecretary of State, informed the British ambassador in Washington of Molotov's suggestions to Schulenburg. The American ambassador in Moscow had wired them to Washington the day before, and they were deadly accurate. Ambassador Steinhardt had seen Molotov on August 16. Hitler was more than willing to discuss such a pact in concrete terms, since its conclusion would keep Russia out of the war and enable him to attack Poland without fear of Soviet intervention. And with Russia out of the conflict, he was convinced that Britain and France would get cold feet. Molotov's suggestions were just what he had hoped for. They were more specific and went further than anything which he had dared to propose. There was only one difficulty. With August running out, he could not wait for the slow Soviet tempo, which was indicated by Molotov's insistence on adequate preparation for the foreign minister's visit to Moscow. Schulenburg's report on his conversation with Molotov was telephoned by the Wilhelmstrasse to Ribbentrop at Fuschl at 6:40 a.m. on August 16, and he hurried across the mountain to seek further instruction from the Führer at Obersalzberg. By early afternoon, they had drawn up a reply to Molotov, and it was rushed off on the teleprinter to Weizsäcker in Berlin with instructions to wire it most urgent to Moscow immediately. The Nazi dictator accepted the Soviet suggestions unconditionally. Schulenburg was directed by Ribbentrop to see Molotov again and inform him that Germany is prepared to conclude a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union, and if the Soviet government so desire, one which would be undenounceable for a term of 25 years. Further, Germany is ready to guarantee the Baltic states jointly with the Soviet Union. Finally, Germany is prepared to exercise influence for an improvement and consolidation of Russian-Japanese relations. All pretense was now dropped that the Reich government was not in a hurry to conclude a deal with Moscow. The Führer, Ribbentrop's telegram continued, is of the opinion that, in view of the present situation and of the possibility of the occurrence any day of serious events, please at this point explain to Monsieur Molotov that Germany is determined not to endure Polish provocation indefinitely. A basic and rapid clarification of German-Russian relations and of each country's attitude to the questions of the moment is desirable. For these reasons, I am prepared to come by airplane to Moscow at any time after Friday, August 18th, to deal on the basis of full powers from the Führer with the entire complex of German-Russian relations and, if the occasion arises, to sign the appropriate treaties. Again, Ribbentrop added an annex of personal instructions to his ambassador. I request that you again read these instructions word for word to Molotov and ask for the views of the Russian government and of Monsieur Stalin immediately. Entirely confidentially, it is added for your guidance that it would be of very special interest to us if my Moscow trip could take place at the end of this week or the beginning of next week. The next day, on their mountaintop, Hitler and Ribbentrop waited impatiently for the response from Moscow. Telegraphic communication between Berlin and Moscow was by no means instantaneous, a condition of affairs which did not seem to be realized in the rarefied atmosphere of the Bavarian Alps. By noon of the 17th, Ribbentrop was wiring Schulenberg most urgent, requesting a report by telegram regarding the time when you made your request to be received by Molotov and the time for which the conversation has been arranged. By dinner time, the harassed ambassador was replying, also most urgent, that he had only received the foreign minister's telegram at 11 the night before, that it was by then too late to conduct any diplomatic business, and that first thing in the morning of today, August 17th, he had made an appointment with Molotov for 8 p.m. For the now frantic Nazi leaders, it turned out to be a disappointing meeting. Conscious of Hitler's eagerness and no doubt fully aware of the reasons for it, the Russian foreign commissar played with the Germans, teasing and taunting them. After Schulenberg had read to him Ribbentrop's telegram, Molotov, taking little note of its contents, produced the Soviet government's written reply to the Reich foreign minister's first communication of August 15th. Beginning acidly with a reminder of the Nazi government's previous hostility to Soviet Russia, it explained that until very recently the Soviet government have proceeded on the assumption that the German government are seeking occasion for clashes with the Soviet Union. Not to mention the fact that the German government, by means of the so-called Anti-Comintern Pact, were endeavoring to create, and have created, the united front of a number of states against the Soviet Union. It was for this reason, the note explained, that Russia was participating in the organization of a defensive front against German aggression. If, however, the note continued, the German government now undertake a change from the old policy in the direction of a serious improvement in political relations with the Soviet Union, the Soviet government can only welcome such a change, and are, for their part, prepared to revise their policy in the sense of a serious improvement in respect of Germany. But, the Russian note insisted, it must be by serious and practical steps, not in one big leap as Ribbentrop proposed. What steps? The first step, conclusion of a trade and credit agreement. The second step, to be taken shortly thereafter, conclusion of a non-aggression pact. Simultaneously with the second step, the Soviets demanded the conclusion of a special protocol defining the interests of the contracting parties in this or that question of foreign policy. This was more than a hint that in regard to dividing up Eastern Europe, at least, Moscow was receptive to the German view that a deal was possible. As for the proposed visit of Ribbentrop, Molotov declared that the Soviet government was highly gratified with the idea, since the dispatch of such an eminent politician and statesman emphasized how serious were the intentions of the German government. This stood, he added, in noteworthy contrast to England, which in the person of Strang had sent only an official of second-class rank to Moscow. However, the journey by the German foreign minister required thorough preparation. The Soviet government did not like the publicity that such a journey would cause. They preferred to do practical work without much fuss. Molotov made no mention of Ribbentrop's urgent, specific proposal that he come to Moscow over the weekend, and Schulenberg, perhaps somewhat taken aback by the course of the interview, did not press the matter. The next day, after the ambassador's report had been received, Ribbentrop did. Hitler, it is obvious, was now growing desperate. From his summer headquarters on the Obersalzberg, there went out on the evening of August 18th a further, most urgent telegram to Schulenberg signed by Ribbentrop. It arrived at the German embassy in Moscow at 5:45 a.m. on the 19th and directed the ambassador to arrange immediately another conversation with Monsieur Molotov, and do everything possible to see that it takes place without any delay. There was no time to lose. I ask you, Ribbentrop wired, to speak to Monsieur Molotov as follows. We, too, under normal circumstances, would naturally be ready to pursue a realignment of German-Russian relations through diplomatic channels, and to carry it out in the customary way. But the present unusual situation makes it necessary, in the opinion of the Führer, to employ a different method which would lead to quick results. German-Polish relations are becoming more acute from day to day. We have to take into account that incidents might occur any day that would make the outbreak of open conflict unavoidable. The Führer considers it necessary that we be not taken by surprise by the outbreak of a German-Polish conflict, while we are striving for a clarification of German-Russian relations. He therefore considers a previous clarification necessary, if only to be able to take into account Russian interests in case of such a conflict, which would of course be difficult without such a clarification. The ambassador was to say that the first stage in the consultations mentioned by Molotov, the conclusion of the trade agreement, had been concluded in Berlin this very day, August 18th, and that it was now time to attack the second stage. To do this, the German foreign minister proposed his immediate departure for Moscow, to which he would come with full powers from the Führer, authorizing me to settle fully and conclusively the total complex of problems. In Moscow, Ribbentrop added, he would be in a position to take Russian wishes into account. What wishes? The Germans now no longer beat around the bush. I should also be in a position, Ribbentrop continued, to sign a special protocol regulating the interests of both parties in questions of foreign policy of one kind or another. For instance, the settlement of spheres of interest in the Baltic area. Such a settlement will only be possible, however, in an oral discussion. This time the ambassador must not take a Russian no. Please emphasize, Ribbentrop concluded, that German foreign policy has today reached a historic turning point. Please press for a rapid realization of my journey and oppose appropriately any fresh Russian objections. In this connection, you must keep in mind the decisive fact that an early outbreak of open German-Polish conflict is possible, and that we therefore have the greatest interest in having my visit to Moscow take place immediately. August 19th was the decisive day. Orders for the German submarines and pocket battleships to sail for British waters were being held up until word came from Moscow. The warships would have to get off at once if they were to reach their appointed stations by Hitler's target date for the beginning of the war, September 1st, only 13 days away. The two great army groups designated for the onslaught on Poland would have to be deployed immediately. The tension in Berlin, and especially on the Obersalzberg, where Hitler and Ribbentrop waited nervously for Moscow's decision, was becoming almost unbearable. The Foreign Office dispatches and memoranda that day disclosed the jittery feelings in the Wilhelmstrasse. Dr. Schnurre reported that the discussions with the Russians on the trade agreement had ended the previous evening with complete agreement, but that the Soviets were stalling on signing it. The signature, he said, was to have taken place at noon this day, August 19th, but at noon the Russians had telephoned saying they had to await instructions from Moscow. It is obvious, Schnurre reported, that they have received instructions from Moscow to delay the conclusion of the treaty for political reasons. From the Obersalzberg, Ribbentrop wired Schulenburg most urgent to be sure to report anything Molotov said or any sign of Russian intentions by telegram. But the only wire received from the ambassador during the day was the text of a denial by TASS, the Soviet news agency, in Moscow, that the negotiations between the Russian and Anglo-French military delegations had become snarled over the Far East. However, the TASS dementi added that there were differences between the delegations on entirely different matters. This was a signal to Hitler that there was still time and hope. And then, at 7:10 p.m. on August 19th, came the anxiously awaited telegram. Secret, most urgent. The Soviet government agree to the Reich Foreign Minister coming to Moscow 1 week after the announcement of the signature of the economic agreement. Molotov stated that if the conclusion of the economic agreement is made public tomorrow, the Reich Foreign Minister could arrive in Moscow on August 26th or 27th. Molotov handed me a draft of a non-aggression pact. A detailed account of the two conversations I had with Molotov today, as well as the text of the Soviet draft, follows by telegram at once. Schulenburg. The first talk in the Kremlin, which began at 2 p.m. on the 19th and lasted an hour, did not, the ambassador reported, go very well. The Russians, it seemed, could not be stampeded into receiving Hitler's foreign minister. Molotov persisted in his opinion, Schulenburg wired, that for the present it was not possible even approximately to fix the time of the journey, since thorough preparations would be required. To the reasons I repeatedly and very emphatically advanced for the need of haste, Molotov rejoined that so far not even the first step, the concluding of the economic agreement, had been taken. First of all, the economic agreement had to be signed and published and achieve its effect abroad. Then would come the turn of the non-aggression pact and protocol. Molotov remained apparently unaffected by my protests, so that the first conversation closed with a declaration by Molotov that he had imparted to me the views of the Soviet government and had nothing to add to them. But he had something, shortly. Hardly half an hour after the conversation had ended, Schulenberg reported, Molotov sent me word asking me to call on him again at the Kremlin at 4:30 p.m. He apologized for putting me to the trouble and explained that he had reported to the Soviet government.